Member of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Economic Advisory Council, a best-selling author whose books have sparked conversations and controversy in equal measure, Sanjeev Sanyal, welcome to India, Russia, and the World.
Pleasure to meet you.
India remains the fastest growing economy in the world, despite several wars that many say are impacting India. What's the reason?
So the last few years have not been kind to us. We obviously had the big COVID shock. We came out of that and then we had the oil spike because of the Russia-Ukraine war. And then subsequently, then we had the whole controversy over Trump tariffs. And of course, more recently, we have the problem with the Iran war related oil spikes. And of course, that is not just about oil. In the case of Iran, there's a large Indian population living in the Middle East, which we need to be worried about. It's also a significant export market in addition to being a source of oil. Despite that, India has on a sustained basis been able to grow at the fastest rate of any major economy in the world. So the latest data, for example, suggests that India's economy grew at 7.8% in the first quarter of this year. This is the January to March quarter. While this is a decently good rate, obviously, we are a poor country. We want to be able to grow even faster than this, but this is a very difficult environment in which to do it. And one of the things that this government has always been quite clear about is that we are never going to pursue growth by, risking macroeconomic instability. So this is the reason that we have been very careful about controlling inflation. If you may have noticed, in the last decade or so, since we introduced the inflation targeting system, India has had inflation in the 2 to 6% range, which is the target range, which is significantly lower than the old 8 to 12% inflation we used to have. Similarly, our external accounts have been kept in reasonable shape. Even in the height of COVID, we were very careful about monetary and fiscal stimulus. So we have been a very conservative government. So despite that, we have been lucky to be able to sustain these high growth rates. But as I said, we hope that in the future, we'll be able to get a clearer road where we could sustain, 8 to 10% GDP growth rates, which is what we would really want to be able to sustain.
A question that many would like to know, Sanjeev Sanyal, is the world heading towards a recession?
Difficult to tell. It's certainly currently growing with many problems on the road. As I just mentioned, the oil price is just one of them. There is also a domestic demand problem in China. There is, of course, another war in Europe and many other uncertainties, not the least because the global trading system has come unstuck because of all these tariff wars. So this is something that is a difficult environment to navigate. Now, as a policymaker, what do I do? One of the responses has been, for example, our response to the global trading system unwinding is to try and have as many FTAs with friendly countries as possible. So we have in recent times pursued one with Australia. We had a pre-existing one with Japan. We now have one with the UK. We are very advanced down the line of having one with the European Union, and some preliminary framework is already in place. And we are also in discussions with the United States. So we are creating this network of bilateral FTAs and relationships in a bid to try and sort of counteract the breakdown of the old multilateral system.
And you were speaking about the wars in the world. How vulnerable do you think India's growth story is in this prolonged geopolitical instability?
We are not a participant in the war directly, but there are many ways in which it affects us. Many of these countries are friendly countries and we export to them and import from them. Russia has been an old friend and we have old trading relations with them. The UAE and many of the countries in the Gulf, even Iran has been a country with which we have trading relations. So these are disruptive environments in which we have to negotiate our way. Of course, the most direct one is energy prices. We are an energy deficit country. And so when energy prices spike up, It is an uncomfortable situation. I mean, ideally, energy should be cheap and plentiful. Our per capita use of energy is still very low. So as we grow as an economy, our per capita usage of energy is almost certainly going to grow because it's so low that there's no chance of it stabilizing. It has to grow to some reasonable level, which means that, you know, we need energy. Now, some of it can be generated at home now, increasingly through solar. So solar has become a major source. Nuclear is another source we are trying to pursue. There have been some explorations and we have found some, for example, gas deposits in the Andaman and Nicobar Islands. So those are as well there, but inadequate. So we continue to be, as far as hydrocarbons are concerned, heavily dependent on the world. And of course, these disruptions in hydrocarbon-rich parts of the world is, something which we find, disruptive.
You said that what India's found so far is not sufficient. So what are India's options then?
In the long run, we will want to move to non-hydrocarbon sources of energy. There are two big sources potentially. One of them is obviously solar.
But do you think India is underutilizing its solar capacity?
Well, we have heavily invested into solar and we are actually now generating quite a lot of it. I mean, yes, not at Chinese levels, but we are out there, as one of the major solar energy producers in the world now. The success of solar, however, has caused its own problems. What happens is, unlike, say, Europe, we need a lot of our energy for cooling. So this is a good thing because, the energy is available in summer for a longer period of time, exactly when the sun shines is when we need the energy. This is good. But the problem is that you end up having this massive spike of energy requirement in the morning a little bit, but more importantly in the evening. And sunsets at that time. So at that time, what happens are our thermal capacities have to be dramatically ramped up in the every evening. And in order to deal with it, this is not an easy thing to do. And it's quite expensive. So you have an awkward situation that, let's say, at midday, energy in India is almost free. I mean, you have 1 rupee or 2 rupees per unit availability. In fact, there are days when so much solar energy is being produced, we actually have to tell our solar producers not to load it onto the grid because it's causing instability in the grid.
Really?
But on the other hand, just a few hours later, when it spikes up in the evening, it actually goes up to 10. In fact, 10 is a hard limit that we have put. This is a major problem. And that requires that we have to, one, have alternative sources. We cannot entirely base it on solar. And secondly, we need to invest into storage in a very big way.
And how is India's grid situation then?
This causes all kinds of problems. So we are now trying to do a few things. One of them is allow flexible pricing to the consumer. So at least the consumer's behavior or industrial behavior tries to take advantage of the excess energy during the day. And not pile it up in the evening when it's expensive. So one is allow flexible pricing. But in the end, we will have to heavily invest into some form of storage. And when conversations on storage happen, people think of EVs and sort of mobile storage. Here we are talking about large-scale static storage, i.e. in one place, to deal with the grid. There are very many ways of doing this. One is, of course, to invest into more batteries, and that we are doing as well. But here, it's an expensive thing to do. A lot of technological breakthroughs need to happen in order for us to shift to something other than lithium. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a lot of progress is being made in sodium, in iron. So that is an area that we may see some movement. But one technology which India has invested heavily into is hydrogen. And so far, hydrogen is not yet good enough to be there. But it's as I said, one of those things where you're 99% of the way and you need to see technology investments and R&D, etc., to do the breakthrough that it really gets going. But still, I would argue that India is, this is an area where India has actually invested a lot. Some of our biggest corporates have invested into it. The government has. Very recently, a hydrogen fuel train, the first in the world, began to run. So we are beginning to invest into hydrogen in a very big way as a way of storing energy.
What about nuclear energy? India has a cooperation with Russia down south. But beyond that,
atomic energy or nuclear energy of any kind has the opposite problem. It produces energy more or less at the same kind of steam. It's a very good source of energy, consequently, as providing you a good base. We have nuclear capabilities for a long time. So we have had nuclear power stations for a long time. So we experienced in this. But again, we are not a uranium-rich country. This is something we procure from countries, including Russia. But now we have, for example, very recently signed a deal with Australia.
Yes.
So that is something that we are doing. But in the end, what India will have to do is to develop its own thorium capability. Thorium is potentially a very big source of nuclear energy. This technology, unfortunately, is not fully developed. Frankly, India should have invested more in this in the past, but now we are working very hard on this. We have lots of thorium deposits, as it happens to be. Our western coast, on the sand on the beach, is basically thorium. So it is potentially a lot of thorium in India that we can use, and there is lots more in our maritime economic zone. Getting this technology going would be an absolutely critical part of our nuclear strategy.
But do you think it's been the West Asia war, the closure of the Strait of Hormuz, that has given India this wake-up call?
Well, the wake-up call came a bit earlier. We have had earlier spikes, including the one caused by the Russia-Ukraine conflict. So it is not the case that we woke up today. But yes, I mean, it provides that continued pressure.
But India still benefited. After the Ukraine war, India started buying so much of discounted, cheap Russian crude. But here, we're...
Buying Russian crude is not so easy. As you may be aware, there are issues of sanctions. And other things that we have to navigate. Even in this particular case, as I said, energy is not the only problem with the West Asia crisis. There are 10 million Indians who live in that area. We have to worry about them. They are also not only a source of remittance, but their physical safety is an issue. There are literally hundreds of thousands of Indian sailors sailing in oceans. Recent conflicts have had casualties, a lot of them in West Asia, but very recently also in the Black Sea. Many of these countries are friendly countries to whom we would like to export the, you know, and as and when the reconstruction starts, we intend to be, partners in that reconstruction.
The world is talking about AI. It's talking about how to regulate AI. Where does India stand in this race? Is India lagging behind?
It is not the case that India is not a player in this at all. So there are some areas where we are building some kind of foundational capability. More importantly, on the applications, India is actually already a reasonably important player. So everybody likes to think only about the foundational models. Hmm. But, you know, it's not like the foundational models, the whole system is going to be used. It's too energy using specialized models, applications of various kinds. Those will be what will actually be the interaction between the average user and the system. That is a place where actually India is doing quite a lot of work. Secondly, even when you're talking about these massive models being built, do remember that a lot of these companies are developing parts of it in their India operations. The global capability centers of Microsoft or Google or Meta or Apple are huge in India. I mean, the huge operations, you go to Bangalore or Hyderabad or Mumbai, even in Noida. So there are a lot of the, even parts of the foundational model being developed by these companies are developed in India. So Indians are developing, not necessarily Indian companies, but Indians certainly are a part of that story here in India.
The Prime Minister talks a lot about AI. India organized the first AI summit in the world. But there's also this debate that it's eventually going to be the West, a certain section in the world, that will decide the rules and then dictate it to the world. Where does India fit in here?
So, of course, we are engaging in multiple levels. And in fact, that conference was a part of that effort to be a part of the conversation. It is important that we are part of the conversation. Artificial intelligence will cause all manner of disruption. We cannot hide from it. We have to embrace it. For example, we need to be clear that a evolving complex system like artificial intelligence invading and connecting through all manner of things leads us to the risk of major systemic breakdowns. So in this situation, I think there has to be a few rules of the game that need to be put together. First of all, we need to create humans in the loop protocols to make sure that you can shut down systems. You need to have explainability audit requirements. Very, very important, we also need to have skin in the game. Now, this is not entirely different from how, for example, we navigate financial markets. So how do regulators manage financial systems? Well, one of the most important criteria they use is skin in the game. It is very clear if there is a misuse or a breakdown, who in the company is responsible for it. We have created a system that the board of directors or whoever, who has skin in the game. But in the AI world, we still have not developed this. Mm-hmm. So it is, when, let's say, something goes horribly wrong, right now, is it the algorithm person who is the who is responsible? Is it the person who gave bad data? Is it the user who actually used it? Who is the person to be held responsible? So we need to create a system where there is clear skin in the game. Who is responsible when things go wrong? Number two, as I said, we have to create partitions between systems. We cannot have a system where everything is connected to everything. This idea of Internet of Everything or artificial intelligence of everything is, in my view, a bad idea. Because on the very same day that your power plant shut down, your aircraft will shut down, your ATM machine will not function, your payment system will blow up.
Tell me honestly, do you have concerns that AI may take away jobs in India, given the fact that the youth unemployment is already in double digits and some would say the Gen Zs are protesting that they don't have enough jobs?
Here, I totally disagree with this idea that AI eats human jobs. It will certainly eat into current jobs. But do remember, every technology does this. I mean, if you go back to the Industrial Revolution, it is the case that, yes, yarn spinning machines and textile technology of the early 19th century caused losses of jobs in those who were using hand-drawn spinning wheels or whatever. It definitely changed. But is it the case that there were fewer jobs of people in the textile industry? That's not the case. Today's textile industry worldwide employs a lot more people than existed in the 18th century. So at every stage, the new technology, particularly disruptive ones like artificial intelligence, will kill off a certain kind of jobs. But it will also create new kind of jobs. So, for example, who knew that podcasting would be a profession? But that's what you do for a living. And yet this profession did not exist, half a generation ago. So my contention is that rather than waste our time thinking about how to protect today's jobs, we need to retrain our workforce and move them into an environment where they're able to take on these new kind of jobs. But I can tell you that as they emerge, our education system and our labor market has to be capable of dealing with this very, very quickly. That is the very important part. And for this reason, the labor market has to be flexible, number one. Two, and this is the key part, our higher education system has to become a lot more attentive to how the job market and opportunities evolve. In this, the old system of giving lectures and curriculums changing at a glacial pace, all that has to go.
Oh, really?
Yes. I think in the future, what will happen is that people will begin working quite early at, say, 18 and pick up skills along the way. And they may be going back and refreshing themselves well into middle age or even old age. So this idea that you concentrate all your higher education right in the beginning of your life and don't pick up any more new skills the rest of your life, that is probably now an outdated model. So university education in the future will probably have to be some combination of working while you're doing your credits. And a lot of it will be hands-on, getting your hand dirty. And very importantly, it will be something you do for the rest of your life.
India and Russia, they've set a target of $100 billion trade by 2030. But looking at the strategic depth of the relationship between New Delhi and Moscow, is that number not a weak number?
Well, I mean, if we can do better than that, why not? But my thing is that rather than focus on this number, let us begin to build the infrastructure required to do this. Now, there is an obvious problem between trading between India and Russia in that Russia does not have warm water ports. The nearest it has is in the Black Sea, not easy place to get to. You have to first go through the Suez and then go through the Bosphorus to reach it. And then there are no train or land-based systems. So it is a much more tricky place for us to interact with. But having said that, we are various infrastructure systems being built. Perhaps once this Iran situation has settled down, we have the Chabahar port may become much more active as into...
You think, have you seen those pictures of the Chabahar port being blasted? I mean,
so, of course, that is not the section that India has been developing. But anyway, I'm talking about a world past this conflict and so on and so forth. So we need to begin to think of how the infrastructure of that trade will come together. And that includes, by the way, not just the physical transportation. It requires payment systems and many other things as well.
And India and Russia have tried using local currencies to trade, which now India is also doing with other countries. How is that working?
Yes, so eventually we do want various kinds of payment mechanisms, trading systems. And, you know, in the long run, not immediately, but in the long run, hopefully the Indian rupee will also become a hard currency.
The rupee is falling and falling hard. Is it going to stop sometime?
No, this is not the way that works. After all, the yen moves around quite a lot. So do other currencies. And I think one of the things that we have to be quite clear about is that in the end, a hard currency is considered hard because the currency is linked to a basket of goods and it shows its ability to maintain value against a basket of goods. Mm-hmm. The single most important thing in the long run is actually purchasing power.
Okay.
And India has been able, for now a decade, clearly been able to maintain inflation control. What we need to do is to not let this, the weakness of the currency, feed through to inflation in any way. Mm-hmm. That is where we need to control
then,
it.
There's nothing to
but
worry
in,
about.
But in the long run, mm-hmm. what matters is whether or not the currency is able to purchase a basket of goods and its ability to do that is maintained.
I also want to ask you, if Russia wasn't under Western sanctions today, do you think that India would have been less important to Russia economically?
That's for Russians to tell us. I mean, I don't know. We hope that we are long-term friends. Russia, throughout this period, we have maintained a good relationship with Russia, mm-hmm. Even if we have been uncomfortable about the Ukraine war, which Prime Minister Modi had expressed explicitly. We have continued to have close relations with Russia and hope to do so into the future.
In the world today, which is very, very turbulent, geopolitically, geographically, which country do you think is best placed economically, a country that's living a life?
Well, I mean, every country has good things happening there, not so good things happening there. I mean, clearly the last 20-odd years have been the time of China. I mean, there's no doubt that China has emerged as a very powerful part of the world. There is no doubt that it is important in global trade. It's a dominant manufacturing power. And, you know, even India, their trades with them, just like every other country in the world.
Despite the border issues.
We may have border issues with them, but they are also our...
the trade is very strong.
Our trade with China is strong. But at the same time, even a China has very serious long-term problems, not the least its demographics. China's population is already shrinking. It has already fallen from 1.4 billion to somewhere in the range of 1.35 billion. There will be decades in this century where China's population will decline by as much as 100 million in a decade. This is not a trivial decline.
Before I actually let you go, I want to know from your eyes, how do you see India being the most populous country in the world today? Is it a good thing or bad?
Do remember, however, that our population growth has also slowed down very dramatically. And in fact, the only reason Indian population is now growing is because Indians are living longer. The year for the peak number of births, children being born in India, happened 25 odd years ago. People don't realize this. In the year 2001, 29 million babies were born in India. Last year, 22.5 million babies were born. So there's already been a very sharp decline in our fertility rates. So much so that, reproductively speaking, our population is no longer growing. We are now, population growth is entirely because we are living longer. Indian longevity is likely to rise. So population will grow for another maybe 25, 30 years. But this phase that we get, which is the next 25, 30 odd years, is what is called the demographic dividend, when you have relatively fewer babies, but you haven't aged such that your aging population is exploding out, as is happening in Japan and now just begun to happen in China as well. And in some ways, this point about Viksit Bharat, the idea of having a developed India by the year 2047, comes from that. It's a sort of wake-up call that, look, we are already into it, and another 25, 30 odd years is the time to make it, because this is when we will be young enough to be and to be able to maximize the demographic dividend.
Sanjeev Sanyal, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.